I am love. Today I declare that I love myself. I do not require anything for this statement to be true. The most important opinion to me is what I think and feel about myself.
So how is loving yourself first crucial to loving everything else in life?
It's one of those things where if you don't love yourself, you're simply not empowered. You know, I think it's a common paradigm in people's mind, and we would dole out that advice quite readily to other people. You got to love yourself first. But what does that really mean? And how does it equate in our lives if we don't love ourselves? And I think that's the reason why. If you think about that and you think, what are the consequences of not loving yourself? That's the answer. So when I didn't love myself, I wasn't empowered because I was more inclined to say mean and awful things to myself. I was more inclined to criticize, put myself down, and just hold myself in a place of disempowerment, and which eventually drove me to feel, you know, shameful, not good enough, depressed. So I think it's a self-evident thing that if you really look at it, there's a million reasons to love yourself. But the bigger question is, are you willing to drop any and all the commentary that doesn't support that love for self?
When I spoke to Steve Lyman, he said something along the lines of that by loving ourselves, some people might equate that to supporting this idea that those people are narcissistic by loving yourself, that that's just not okay. But he says it's good to just give yourself permission to love yourself. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, and what it does is as soon as you give yourself even the slightest permission to love yourself, it's a way of inviting the divine or the creator to come and be with you. One of my favorite authors, Thomas Keating, he talks about that. He said, all we need to do is look toward the divine, and the divine comes all the way to us. So what I find that with just a small amount of willingness to love myself, it gives me a great deal of reward, and the impact has been really profound in my life. But really loving yourself does require all things that are not loving to be put up for debate, because it's only a concept when it's not actually put in practice. Mm-hmm. If you say, yeah, I love myself, I'm going to give myself permission to do that, that's great. That's your entry point. And then to actually do it is another whole realm to step into. To actually love yourself, you have to be willing to set down dialogues that are not loving. You have to be willing to pull yourself out of situations that are not loving. You have to be willing to pull yourself away from people in your life that are not loving. Or if you're working in a factory or somewhere and your coworkers are not loving, you have to love yourself enough to, you know, either go get something done about the harassment, or you have to love yourself enough not to give that other person power in your mind or chisel you down so you don't love yourself.
Yeah, and that sort of thing where that would be a fairly common concern for a lot of people, wouldn't it, to put themselves first like that? Mm-hmm. I think that's difficult for some people to do. Like, they don't deserve to love themselves. Is that a possibility?
Sometimes. In a disempowered place where you're not loving yourself or you're not putting yourself first in your life, all kinds of mindsets are employed. And there's justification for all of it. I've heard people tell me reasons why other people are more important than them. I know people that would put their pets above themselves. like a pet is more worthy than they are. You know, but again, in an empowered mindset, or if you move into an empowered place where you actually do love yourself, you actually love yourself, then all of that changes. Your love for self is never put up for debate. You know, any sight of moving into a place that's not loving with yourself is territory you're not willing to traverse.
Yeah, and also at the start of this chapter, you say when it comes to love, and I quote, "The deeper you go, the greater it gets." And so what does that mean exactly?
That's my experience. I was just reading a book the other day by Henry Drummond. And in this book, he said, love is a universal language. It would take you years to learn Chinese or the dialects of India, but from the day you land, you understand the language of love. And so love resides at the deepest depths of our being. And it's the first quality that we emanate when we're born. Love just emanates out of us naturally. It's at the core of our being. So when we learn how to love and to dive into the deeper aspects of love, that love gets, it's like there's a trench in us, and it goes right to the core of who we are. So, and it gets deeper and greater. And the reason why it gets deeper and greater is because the deeper we go into love, the further we go into God, the further we dive into the belly of God. And that's why I say it gets greater.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I wonder too, with some people, you were saying that they might put their pets above themselves in that respect, or other people, and they think that that's maybe a noble thing to do. I wonder why people suppress the need to love themselves first, though. I wonder why some people might not think that that's more important than anything else that you're going to love. Because this is all, you know, everything's residual from once you love yourself, it's easier to love other people. It doesn't even feel like as much work at that point. If you don't really love yourself and you're putting everything first,
you can't access something that you don't know anything about. If we haven't spent enough time going into loving self, or if we have a perverted sense of what love is, how do you miss that? If you've never had apple pie, you won't wake up at 3 a.m. pining for it. So it's one of those things where I think a certain amount of people have experienced a very limited or conditional love in their life. They actually haven't understood and embraced the deeper levels of what love is about. So that's why I think sometimes people will go into places that's not loving towards themselves, because they haven't really experienced the depth of what love has to offer. You know, it's kind of like that quote that we read a few sessions back about going to the ocean with a small cup.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the ocean didn't want to provide or couldn't provide. It's just we only went there with a small cup. And the same applies for love. The deeper we dive into it, the more we can get out of it.
I also think you made a good point in saying that we all make mistakes. And when you do make a mistake, instead of beating yourself up over it, that's the time to love yourself more. So how did you come up with that? And what does that mean? Like, let's unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah, I spent a great deal of my life beating myself up. And nobody was more violent to me than I was to myself. So when I used to beat myself up, I was disempowering myself even further. And what I learned from what I had learned from years of beating myself up was that when I made a mistake, that was the time when I needed to be loving and kind to myself. And the same applies to others as well. This is a concept that we bring into the relationship portion of my book. I talk about that. When your partner is at their worst, that's when you have to be at your best. If they make a mistake, what if they lose the keys to the car? Well, they already feel bad. They've lost the keys. They don't need us to yell at them on top of that. They need someone to come along and say, they're just keys. We're going to get through this. It's okay to make mistakes. Because that's the way life is we learn the most through mistakes. So hopefully we make a whole bunch more. You know, it's the worst time in the world to start beating ourselves up. You know, and I think I did it long enough that I learned that I'm not willing to do that anymore. I just decided that my self-worth is no longer up for debate from myself or another.
Now, I wonder if somebody, like using that example you just talked about with the keys, if someone loses the keys and then someone comes along and really gives them a hard time about it, is that in some way, shape, or form the ego defending, like as a person putting up a defense for their own mistakes or the things that they realize that they've done wrong? Is that what that is, do you think? Like their ego projecting? Or what is that exactly, I wonder?
Do you think your soul would be upset if your partner lost the keys to your van?
Not likely.
You think your soul would be upset if your partner threw the keys to the van in the ocean?
I might be, but...
But who are you? Are you your mind? Are you your thoughts? Or are you your soul? Because the mind would be pissed off. And I'm to be honest, maybe my mind would be pissed off too. I'd be like, what are you doing? Don't throw the keys in the water. But the truth of it, the real truth of it is that the part of us that's angry is only our mind anyways. And when we're loving in those times where the mind wants to be angry, if we employ love, we're actually coming at our partners with our soul engaged, with the essence of who we truly are. Because I'm not my mind. You know, if you stopped thinking, you wouldn't cease to exist.
Mm-hmm. Let me present then something to you then. Because this is something I'm having a little difficulty with, because let's say, for example, that your spouse is a pyromaniac and they torched the house because they had an urge. Mm-hmm. Am I not to get totally pissed off about that? Or am I supposed to be like, it's okay, honey. It's just a house. Do you feel me?
Well, I'm not sure that I would date a pyromaniac. I would have to ask you, what drew you to this person?
I'm just presenting like an extreme circumstance. Just an extreme circumstance where... I think that's the only reaction that I would expect is to be upset by something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to paint a picture, because I would imagine listeners will be thinking, yeah, but certain things happen and this is it reasonable to get, because everybody needs a consequence too sometimes, right? Like I understand what a menial thing with keys, then yeah, maybe yeah, we need to be in check with ourselves about that. That's unreasonable to lose your shit. Like the consequence of you losing your temper is worse than them losing the keys. Like you've done more damage with the way you've interacted with her or him or whatever, than the keys being lost. But then there's sometimes where there needs to be a consequence. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that you lose your mind over it, mm-hmm. but I'm just wondering, like, if to love them more, is that always a positive affirmation, or can love also be a consequence? Can you be loving to someone by teaching them a lesson?
In the context of the question that we asked, anger is not an appropriate response, but anger, it doesn't negate the fact where anger can be necessary and useful in a situation. In the context of the question, we're talking about loving someone when they're in it, going through a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually in loving ourselves when we mess up. So in the context of that scenario, love for self, you know, shouldn't be replaced with anger or, you know, frustration with ourselves. It love bridges the space between returning back to a peaceful place much quicker than anger. Now, is anger appropriate? Yes, in certain situations. Anger is the most appropriate way to respond to if somebody's harming your child. You're given all that emotion to use, but anger to scold another adult for losing keys is just your ego running rampant. Because your partner doesn't need to be taught a lesson through anger, that your words in love speak much deeper and more clearly to the person. If your partner is not willing to listen to you and communicate back and forth, then it's not anger that's required to make a better dialogue or a more respectful conversation. You know, if we have to resort to becoming angry with people we love, then we're clearly not communicating properly, and that would be required to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
But anger, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, so like another picture I'll paint with that is, say you live on a busy road and your child keeps going to the road, and you've told them numerous times, don't go to the road, it's dangerous. And then one day they go to the road and there's a close call, and then punishment is dealt, but it's because you love them. Mm-hmm. And that would be appropriate too, right? But I would think so. Yeah. It's just, yeah, I guess the tricky thing with this is everyone's going to have their own perception on what is excessive and what isn't enough. Mm-hmm. And like finding the balance of what's effective, appropriate, and not long-term damaging to someone else because we can't control our emotions and our behaviors.
Yeah, when it comes a concern for the safety of your child and they're not listening, then anger may be an appropriate response to them walking towards the road to really shake them out of what they're in. However, most of the time, 9 times out of 10, anger is not the appropriate response. There's so many emotions that we can express through. There's so many modes and ways to communicate that, you know, for me, the most loving I can be, it creates the best dialogues. It's been a blessing in my life how embracing things with love has created a solution much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, love sometimes calls me to settle down and just relax, just breathe for a minute. The most loving thing I can do sometimes is just kind of calm myself down when I get angry, because it doesn't mean that we don't ever get angry either. You know, if your partner does something and anger does come up, that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with feeling angry. The only thing that would be wrong is if you start projecting it and abusing your partner. You know, there's a time and a place. And sometimes anger's needed to shift a situation very quickly. It just kind of snaps people out of that.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to know what your advice would be to someone who addresses their negative past and can't come to love themselves. Like, what if someone's listening to this and they think, well, Ned and Seamus, my past is so broken and I've been told I'm worthless for so long that I actually don't have enough in me to value myself to the point of loving myself? Because I think that's a pretty critical thing. I don't want anyone who's listening to this feel like they're excluded from the possibilities of this conversation that we're having, and that these things don't apply to certain people. So I'd like for you to bring some light to that for those who might be questioning whether it's possible to love themselves.
Okay, so we ready ourselves to drop our past when we can embrace love. Now, when I'm able to just really fully embrace love, then it makes a much easier space for me to just keep going further and further into that. Now, if you're having a hard time, then what I think was necessary for me when I used to have a hard time loving myself is we can start with thinking about the qualities of love. And what are the qualities of love? Love is patient. Love is kind, generous, humility. It's courteous. It's unselfish. It's good-tempered. It's honest. It's sincere. You know, these are a good chunk of the main qualities of love. So when you find it hard to address love for yourself, which one of these qualities do you need to put in place? Do you need to be more patient? Is that the quality that the moment requires? Do you need to be more kind? Do you need to be unselfish? Do you need to be good-tempered? You know, if you ask yourself, what does this moment require? Does it require generosity, humility? And by looking at the qualities of love, they're actually signposts on how to go further into it. You know, I urge the listeners right now to make a list. Make a list of the qualities of love. Make your own list. Come up with more words on your list than I've just shared. And when you find it difficult to embrace a little bit of self-love, go to the list and say, what is it that I need to employ here? And that could be a first step in practicing how to love yourself, how to employ it even when you have the most horrific past. In the book, I say that loving self is not an action that you perform once. It's something that we reinsert daily. We reinsert loving ourselves sometimes moment to moment. And this is such an important task to begin to master in our life. When we address the sense of loving self from one moment to the next, it changes the dynamic of so many things in our life. This chapter is one of the chapters of the book that's very dear to me. My campaign in the last year and a bit has been Be Love. We created a fundraiser where we did Be Love tattoos on people. I just had a few thousand vinyl stickers cut that says Be Love, and we're sticking them on cars all over the place. My book's called Be Love. Love is a doorway into the deeper aspects and the union with God. It brings the essence of our Creator into the moment we're in. And I'm not talking about God and religion. I'm talking about the God that lives inside your soul. The depth of who you are is rooted in the nature of love. So it's one of those qualities. It's the essence of life. And if we can just get a handle on how to apply love and start to work towards bringing more and more of that in our lives, your life will radically change. And that I will guarantee you, because it's turned my life upside down. It's brought so much goodness into my life. It's positioned me to see things that I never thought possible to happen. You know, I even thinking about it just wells up some emotion, appreciation for the quality of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the opportunity to sit here with you right now is because of love.
The bottomless nature of love is revealed to you when you fall in love with yourself.
And like when you were a young man and you're going through your difficulties and your struggles, did you think that anything like this would be possible for you? Or did you think that was not within reach?
No, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know the depth of I was afraid, and I didn't have a clue. When I was the most scared and afraid and angry in my life, I forgot that I was love. and I forgot that I was the love that I was searching for. I was looking for love outside of me. I was looking for somebody to give it to me, you know. So,
yeah, I can relate to that. That makes a lot of sense to me. I think in those situations too, when you're disempowered, you feel that you are incapable of giving yourself what you actually need. And then you do look for others to fulfill that for you.
That's right.
And then what if they're not around when you're, you know, feeling down or something like that? You definitely have to rely on yourself, as it says many, many times throughout the book, that you need to be able to supply yourself with that. That's incredibly important.
And that's the importance of learning to love yourself, learning to care for yourself, to be your own support team in life.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And so how would you say then that loving yourself, how's that put you in touch with your soul?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I just was going into that. The soul in me, what I've discovered is that my soul is made from love. Love is to God as the weave is to cloth. You know, they are inseparable, and you cannot have God without love, and your soul is God. And when you know love, you know your soul, and you know God as well. Okay, that's a lot right there, okay?
Yeah, you're saying that your soul is God?
Yeah. Yeah, your soul is God inside of you. And, you know, this is something that a lot of people have a hard time talking about. Or they think it, maybe this would be blasphemy to say that your soul is God. Well, I'm not talking about your ego. And Thomas Keating, one of my favorite authors, he's a Trappist monk. And the Trappist order is part of the Catholic order of monks. He said that you are not only made up in God's image, you are God in every sense of the word. You know? That's coming from a very high-level Catholic monk. And I think this is a paradigm that needs to be maybe talked about, because that's what we're missing. When we don't love, we're missing God. that's a pretty out there concept. But that's how I feel about it. So now, I don't want to throw the word God in front of everybody's face so much. So I just tend to talk about love. But if I get right down to the brass tacks here, you know, this is the core of what I believe. And I'm not the only one that understands this concept or that is following along this type of dialogue. It's getting to be a wider known fact in that people are coming to that. This idea that we're less than is the thing that perpetuates our excuses not to love self. You know, there was a paradigm that was shoved in our faces and thrown around for many years that we're not worthy and we're not good enough. We're not this, we're not that. We're sinners. It's all that was then and this is now. And I think it's time that humanity embraced love. You know, if you don't want to talk about God or claim your position with the Creator, that's cool. I don't care. You don't even have to believe a word I say. But if we could just position ourselves that we loved ourselves and we loved each other, there'd be a massive shift in the world.
Oh, yeah.
You want to talk about an awakening? That would be an awakening.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I feel like up till now, we haven't really discussed God yet. Mm-hmm. We haven't really mentioned that word. And I feel that there might be people that have their own fixed belief, you know, whatever that may be, some kind of religion. And it's not, like you said, this isn't about convincing or trying to coerce people into not believing in whatever that is that they believe, that this is like foundationally within yourself. But I do feel that clarification is also kind of important as well, that if we look at it from, because I'm very neutral with this. I am not a religious person. I've never have been. I've attempted it, but there was just too much stuff in there that it just didn't sync with my logic or what I grew up with as being logic. So to me, I just couldn't get on board with it. This, however, seems far more tactile. Like there's actually something to this that my logic actually agrees with. And the thought that God is within us and that if we are good to ourselves and that we love ourselves like that, that the good things can come, seems a lot healthier to me than this hierarchical sort of idea that we're down here and God is way up here. Mm-hmm. That seems healthier to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It certainly, when I learned how to love and go deeper into the love in me, I found a deeper relationship with a much larger aspect of me. And it's divine in nature. Like my relationship with love is just such a boundless adventure. That I feel so much, feel like I'm taken care of. There's something there inside me that just takes care of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the essence of the love in me.
Well, and the thing is, as well as knowing you and having the conversations and the interactions that we've had over the years, there is something, it's difficult to say what it is, but everybody projects something. Mm-hmm. Subconsciously, even. It's like that's just the aroma they put out.
That's right.
That's just part of their being, right? Mm. Yours is, I've never had a conversation or spent time with you where I left feeling depleted, mm-hmm. or judged, mm. or disliked or not welcomed. It's very neutral, yet there is a lot of like a warmth to your energy, like the way that you feel to be around, and an authenticity to it as well. Like it's sincere. Mm-hmm. That everything that you talk about and everything I've read in your book synchronizes with who you are as a person. So it's not like here's Ned over here and then this is something he wrote and then the two somehow just don't seem to correlate. Like they are in perfect unison, I feel, mm-hmm. knowing you the way I do anyway.
Yeah, the book is my experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that came out of my mind, a fantasy that I created. And the thing about the further you go into love in yourself and into the soul, the more truthful your experience is. It's a more sincere relationship that you're the most sincere and truthful relationship you'll ever have is the one you're having with your soul. And the thing about the further I go into my soul, the more I understand your soul. And so there'll be a truth and a resonance that naturally exudes from me to you. And it'll be familiar and okay. Your soul won't have a problem with that. And usually we can kind of bypass the mind in the process too.
Well, this is, again, something that Steve had talked about. He's a Buddhist. And he said that you and I are no different. And that for me, as an example, to care about what happens to me means that I should also care about what happens to you, because mm-hmm. it's the exact same.
Yeah. And this is the concept that we'll talk about in session number 9, where we're going to talk about unity, because that's mm-hmm. in the book. The chapter Unity talks about there's a thread that ties us both together. And then I think we're going to go a lot deeper into these concepts of unity and what is that. But love is the universal force that does tie all of us together. You know, love is to God is the weave is the cloth, you know. So if you think of a big giant piece of cloth, it takes a weave to hold it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we are love. and the love is the weave. So we're, you and I are held together through love. It's a common thread that ties us both together. And no matter how far away that we're still bind to each other. But the further we go into the soul, the smaller the gap comes between you and I. So.
Now, another thing I would like to discuss is what is conditional love? And this is kind of a toxic thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what are some of the common reasons do you feel why people might be conditional with love?
Well, first off, they don't understand what love is. So it, in conditional love is nothing more than a bargaining tool of the ego. So when you're projecting a conditional love, you'll say, like to a child, if you don't behave, you're not getting ice cream. This is a very simplified version. But we do this as adults. If you don't behave the way I want you to behave, I'm cutting off my love to you. So it's love can sometimes become this bargaining chip that we sort of dangle in the air and say, you do this or else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's conditional love. That kind of love is born out of our own suffering. That kind of love is born out of our own traumas and the things that we've gone through. And that kind of love isn't love at all. It's not even remotely close to what love is.
Right, right.
When love needs nothing, and love is more than a desire. You know, if you breaking one of my desires causes me to not love you, then I never loved you to begin with.
Everyone hold on to that thought for a minute. That's awesome.
Yeah. And that's the very truth of what conditional love is. When you have a desire, you're really just projecting a desire onto someone. I want you to do this. If you're not willing, then because you're not fulfilling my desire, I'm not going to do this for you. So you're not really you're not holding back anything anyways when you don't give your supposed love to another for breaking your desires.
This is kind of interesting, though. If we're using love, as you said, a bargaining chip simply to manipulate someone, then we understand to some degree what love is because we know that someone else needs it. And by removing that is a big deal. And people think that that's a pretty massive consequence. So I just think that that's just really, really cruel. It's incredibly cruel to do something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember I was out visiting a tattooist, and I'm not going to mention whose name it is, but this tattooist tattooed some really bad people. Like he tattooed a lot of criminals. But the tattooist himself was actually he was a very kind man and very gentle, caring, nurturing. But when I went to visit him, every time he'd have criminals in his chair, some of which may have even included the act of murder. So this guy, this tattooist I know, was tattooing some really bad people. So I was out for dinner with him one night because I allowed myself in his life because of his nature, not the company he was keeping. The company he was keeping was like, I don't know if I want to get involved, but his nature was just so beautiful. So I was out for supper with him, and he was a very high-level tattooer, and I said, can I be honest with you? He's like, oh, yeah, ask me any question you want. I said, why do you tattoo criminals and people that may have committed murder? And he says, that's a very good question. He says, but I have an answer for that. And he says, what do you need in this world? And he threw the question onto me. And I said, well, we need clothing. He goes, okay, aside from shelter and clothing and food, what do we need? And I said, well, I think we need people that care about us. And he says, you need love. And he said, So my job, when these people come in and get tattooed by me, he says, my job is to love them. And regardless, he goes, I don't ask them what they do for a living. And I may be the only person in this world that actually loves these people. He says, but that's my role. That's my job, is just to love them. And I, in that moment, I wasn't in the place I am today. And I couldn't understand it, because I hadn't gone deep enough into the love in myself. I couldn't understand how he could be so unconditional. At that point in my life, I thought, you're a better man than me. And he was. He was a better man than me in that moment. He understood a depth of love that I had yet been able to obtain. And now in this portion of my life, I really understand the nature and what love is all about. So when I see conditional love, I can spot that a mile away. You know, in one of the biggest things about when we're conditional with love is that it's because we don't love ourselves. And, you know, we'll say and do the most harmful things to ourselves. And it goes back to the beginning of this session where we're talking about how, you know, loving ourselves first is critical. I remember my friend Jeff Roberts telling me a story about he had a drug addiction and he went to rehab. And while he was in rehab, he had this experience and he shared it with me and allowed me to put it in my book. And I'd actually like to read the story now. Like
please.
It's one of those really telling stories. So this is Jeff Roberts' story. Plagued by depression and suicide attempts, alone in his head and hiding from his feelings and emotions, he truly was a lost soul. At the beginning of a 90-day program for flushing substances out of his body, surrounded by strangers who were also suffering emotional pain, he had no choice but to face his emotions head on. He had to relearn himself, find himself. And this was a very frightening thing to do. One unique yet impactful exercise given to him was to write down all the negative things he had told himself throughout the day. The list was long, and what he wrote was terrible and filled with many negative thoughts. Why bother? I hate myself. I hate my life. I'm a loser. Once he had finished this list, he handed it to his counselor. During the course of the next 6 weeks of group therapy and one-on-one counsel, he had completely forgotten about his list. Then one sunny day, while resting in a hammock, another person taking the program approached him. This person, using a negative tone, began saying all the unsavory things to him, like, why are you even here? You're a loser. You're just wasting time. After a few minutes, Jeff began to get angry and frustrated with the person and was getting ready to hit him when Jeff's counselor intervened, stuck the piece of paper in his face and said, if he can't say these things to you, then why on earth is it okay for you to say them to yourself? You know, what a story. And I think about my life and how I would say things to myself that was not loving, and how this it rings so true.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's kind of funny because I remember reading that portion of the book and I was kind of like wondering, okay, well, like, how's this going to end? Like, I was just wondering how this is going to finish up. And I'm trying to relate to Jeff as myself in his position, right? So when someone comes up to you and starts barking at you like that, my reaction would probably be quite similar to his. But then it's not until the very end where it all comes around and it makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Something clicks inside your own head when you're reading it saying, yeah, mm-hmm. He's got a very good point there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, man. Now, something else you say in the book too is that the longest standing battle in your life is not being fought outside of yourself. It is actually the one that's happening in your mind. The arguing and temper tantrums in your mind will continue until you decide the war is over. When you decide to love yourself, your desire to wrestle with your internal conflicts loses spark. I like that part. Is it really that easy to get over our self-defeating habits? You just love yourself and they just go away, or?
That's a great question. That's the thing. They don't just go away. And this is where devotion has to be inserted in your practice of loving yourself. You have to get in love with loving yourself. And you do that until you don't need to do it anymore. But in some of these things, these self-defeating habits, they'll keep coming up in your mind. I remember I was about a month or so into a two-month meditation retreat, and I was right at the height of my frustration. Going for meditation for longer than a week or 2 weeks at a time is really difficult. It tends to bring up some really deep stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about going on retreats. I went on quite a few retreats with the Ashaya monks, and they were some of my most trying times. It sounds glamorous, that, and it sounds like it'd be a time that was full of peace and joy. And maybe for the other monks it was, but I wasn't having that experience. I remember going into these meditation retreats and getting really pissed off, because when the dust kind of cleared in my life and I just kind of relaxed, then some of my deeper issues started coming forward.
Mm.
So and this is the thing, this was my question. When do these self-defeating thoughts stop? I'm sitting in sunny Mexico, living in a 500-year-old hacienda, beautiful grounds. There's an ashram and there was an old church built on the site, and naturally spring-fed swimming pool and sweat lodge, Temescal, and but yet I was angry, and these old dialogues in my mind kept coming forward while I'm trying to meditate in this beautiful space, eating fresh fruit.
Yeah.
Next to having somebody fanning me. It should have been a good time. Why was I not having a good time? So I went to Maharishi, and I'm pissed off. And I said, Maharishi, when does this stop? When does it end? When does all these angry thoughts in my mind stop? And he says, when you learn to love yourself. He said, these angry thoughts no longer have control over you. When you learn how to change your relationship to the voice in your head that you think is you. So there's voices in your head, and you think that's who you are, but you are not a voice in your mind. That's not who we are. The depth of our being that resides in our soul is much bigger than a voice in your head. The voice in your head is nothing more than your ego. And the thoughts dropping into you, it's not you. The voice that's responding back to those thoughts is not you.
Mm-hmm.
Maharishi, another thing he used to always say is that the last voice in your mind that dissolves is the one that you think is you.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's pretty illustrative, that the depth of who we are, we're not our voice. We're not a voice in our mind. So these, and we're not a self-defeating habit. That's not who we are.
Mm.
A self-defeating thought. That's not who we are. And so our job is just to stay anchored into the presence of love and pointed toward the soul. Point our attention inward toward the soul.
Yeah. So something that I think a lot of people are familiar with is the term self-violence. How would you say you define that term?
Self-violence is any thought or behavior or action that takes you away from loving yourself. And it happens in many ways. We just shared one with the mm-hmm. Jeff Roberts story. It's not just being, not just an angry voice in your head either. It's also the voice that repeats the same commentary that's trapped in your mind. When a collection of thoughts causes you distress, worry, or have anxiety, it's violent to allow yourself to keep thinking those thoughts. We don't think of self-violence as as the words that we project in our mind just repeatedly. Like, I got to pay my taxes.
This is what I'm talking about, because I think a lot of people think that it's manifested in physical violence to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like when I read self-violence without knowing how you define the term, mm-hmm. and I'm sure other people would also relate to this, that it sounds like, you know, self-mutilation or cutters and those types of things, or people who just cause pain to themselves so that they feel something, or that's what they say. But you're saying that self-violence can be just mental anguish as well. That's just repeating over and over again.
Is it not violent to repeat yourself all day back about something that, that may be stressful?
Absolutely. Back to the Jeff Roberts story, it'd be like having someone just telling me what's going on in my head and just screaming it at me all day. Mm-hmm. That would be a form of violence.
What if you had a Visa bill for $300 and you didn't have the money? And all day long, you talked in your mind about $300 that you didn't have, and there was no way you were going to get that money until the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
So is it not a form of self-violence to keep reminding yourself of that $300 bill? We don't think of that as violence. That sort of stuff goes under the radar. Maybe 1 in 100 people cut. I don't know the statistics on cutting or self-mutilation, but I can tell you that the statistics on the violent behavior that happens between our ears will be far greater than any other form of violence.
And no one can ever see it. Mm-hmm. That's the scariest part, is how much people can conceal when it comes to this. You know, if it's in the physical form of self-violence, it's much harder to hide that than it is anything that's going on in your head.
Well, it's sort of the violence towards herself. It starts out sometimes in the most innocent way. It's like if we do, and I talk about this in the book. So if we do something that we think, well, that was stupid. And then we may say that out loud, or if we're in company of friends, you go, oh man, that was stupid. And then if we do it again, you say, stupid, so stupid. And maybe the second or third time you do it, you may say, I am so stupid. Why do I keep doing that? So we can slowly turn a dialogue from something being stupid to I'm stupid. And that's how the commentaries of the mind can start to turn on ourselves. Mm-hmm. If we embrace these negative mindsets and allow ourselves to get over carried away, or to get carried away with our emotions, then we start to turn these things on ourselves, and we personalize the commentaries that we have in mind. And instead of, you know, that being stupid, it's I'm stupid. You know, and then we start to wear it like a label. And the next thing you know, like you're shaking your head, and it's throwing you into a very deep disempowerment.
So why do you think that people turn to self-violence to reduce themselves like that? Is it because it's easy?
I think it's a habit. There's a lot of, and like I say, we start with a simple, it being simple, and then we work our way into deeper and deeper aspects of becoming more violent towards ourselves. And we're not really given a lot of lessons on how to love ourselves. You know, I did a charity event, and I tattooed Be Love tattoos on hundreds of people. Every person that sat in my chair the day I did my event, almost every single one, I asked them, I said, how do you know how to love yourself? Oh, yeah. And so I took it one step further. I said, how do you do that? And out of all the people I tattooed that day, I think there were only two people that actually knew how to love themselves. When I really questioned somebody in my chair, say, how do you love yourself? They didn't know.
What kind of answers would they give you?
They didn't.
They didn't only have
two
one?
People, only two people, and I think one or two people told me how they loved themselves.
And how did they love themselves?
I can't remember. It was because I spent the whole day sharing how I love myself.
Gotcha.
But that was one of the things that I walked away that I was very alarmed. to hear that a lot of people didn't know how to love themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would tell them, you know, when you love yourself, it's a matter of being patient and kind to yourself, you know, and we love ourselves when we're not violent in our thoughts. We love ourselves when we don't overwork. You know, if I remember working myself into exhaustion, and the Ashayas told me, they said, you know, if you don't give yourself rest, it's a form of self-violence. And it really stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah, no doubt. Because it's oftentimes congratulated to work lots.
That's right.
You get rewarded. Mm-hmm. More money. More stuff. Now, there's another thing, too, like a habit that can develop. And I have some familiarity with this one. And that's with looping thoughts. And we kind of touched on it a little bit. Like when you talked about the credit card debt, $300, you can't pay for it until the end of the month.
Yeah.
And then that starts coursing through your mind. Well, here's that thing. Like that, those kinds of thoughts can perpetuate quite a lot of anxiety and stress, fear, and then guilt, just as a few examples. Those are the ones that came to mind for me. How can we end that? Like, how can we put it to rest that, yes, I can't solve that today, I can solve that next week, and to feel okay that you may not have the means to deal with the problem at the time being? Like in this case, we'll talk about money. So I think that's pretty universal amongst people.
Now, when we focus on the things that bring up anxiety, fear, and guilt, by allowing ourselves to keep revisiting these ideas, anxiety, fear, guilt, shame, all these emotions just get bigger and bigger. So the more attention you put on them, the bigger they get. The thing with looping thoughts that perpetuate anxiety, stress, fear, guilt, when we put all of that attention on it, they disempower us. And in the process, when we become disempowered, we have less power to move into more of a loving place. And I don't think that we should change a thought with another thought. We covered that in the first session. If you're feeling stressed and worried about something, I don't think we replace it with positivity. You know, positivity right. doesn't actually fix the problem.
Sure.
You know, I think common sense and ability to and a willingness to set it down until needed would be more stress reducing than saying, oh, well, maybe tomorrow the money fairy will come.
It's crazy how many times, though, that by setting down your thoughts alleviates a problem. Mm-hmm. I hope that the listeners are starting to understand and see this pattern that's going on here.
Yeah.
The things that we're discussing, that by putting down your thoughts when they have absolutely zero benefit to you other than a detriment, that we need to do that.
My old teacher used to say, one of my old teachers used to say that there are no present moment problems.
What does that mean exactly? I'm having difficulty with that.
I still have a bit of difficulty with that myself. But the sense that I get from that is that right now, in this moment that we're in, if my pants were on fire, it wouldn't be a problem so much as I'd just deal with it.
Right.
You know, and the problems that we're having generally are things that have to do with the future and the past.
Right.
Like you think about your problems that you have right now in this moment. You know, there may be a looming this or that, but is it a problem right now? Because there's absolutely nothing you can do with it. There's nobody standing over you with a potato peeler asking for skin. You know, like it's just most of our problems are not happening in the moment we're in.
Fear cannot live in a house love rules.
That's good food for thought.
And the idea is that we learned how to embrace love and to hold our attention on the heart. And a great deal of the stresses that we're feeling can subside. But when we're trapped in the mind, that sounds nearly impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we go back to the first session, go back to the first chapter of my book, and get real intimate with what's going on in your head and start learning how to set those dialogues down.
Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing too. Like, you had discussed this with me before, but because of the flow of the podcast being identically the flow of the book as far as chapters and so on, you were saying that the first part of the book is subjective and moves more to objective themes, and then spirituality towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense. Like, if people go back and they really do a deep dive, a deep forensic on what's going on in their head, a whole lot more of what we're talking about now and into the future parts of the show are going to make a hell of a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, in the chapter of love, you introduced the topic of fear. Why did you choose to introduce fear into this chapter?
People often think that fear is the opposite of love, or hate is the opposite of love, but this is not true. Love has no opposite. I've had people say, well, everything in this world is subject to duality. But the thing about love itself is it's not of this world. You know, it's actually divine in nature. So, and because of my understanding with love, I don't believe that God has an opposite. So if love is God, and God has no opposite, and the idea of Satan is a really great fairy tale for those who like to believe in it. I believe there's evil in the world, but Satan's not the opposite of God. So fear is a slayer of love. Nothing slays love, or it takes away our ability to maintain awareness of love than fear. It's a mindset that only makes us heavy and weak. When I'm fearful, I'm heavy and weak, or I'm swinging, you know, like mm-hmm. in the most fearful moments of our lives, we're disempowered, you know, or we're swinging, and that has nothing to do with love at all. So fear has a way, and it's a tactic that was used to control because of its ability to squash out power. You know, when we're fearful, we become powerless. We tend to freeze.
Now, I've seen quotes such as fear is a lie. Is there such thing as good fear and bad fear? Like, is there a way, like, is fear a lie? Like, how do you respond to that quote?
Well, there's logical fears, but then there's some other fears. Most fears are not logical. You know, if you were to walk out to the edge of a rooftop, there's nothing to fear if you don't fall off the edge. And once you do fall off the edge, what's the fear then? The only time you'd actually be in fear is while you're falling, and depends how high you're falling from is how long you'd truly be in fear. But does fear keep you safe from falling off the edge of a roof if you're walking close to it? I would say logic keeps you from falling off the roof. You know,
I would agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I think that having a logical mindset and using your mind, this is where the mind's a tool. You pick it up and you say, okay, don't put your hand on the stove. It's hot. You know, and you would teach your child not to put their hand on the stove because it's hot. But if you were to sit around all night ruminating on the fact that maybe your child could burn their hand, would that be healthy and productive?
Mm-mm.
No, not really. And it certainly, the fear of falling off a roof wouldn't keep you from falling off. The logic that says don't go too close to the edge. would be the thing to employ. Again, fear is just is something that tends to ruminate in our body. It's something that we ruminate on, and the residual effect of when we ruminate on fear is it disempowers.
And you also say too that worry is the slayer of love. Should I not worry? Just as an example, like I know we're bringing up children. It's common, I guess. Like I have a child. Like, can we worry about kids? Like, say, like they don't come home on time. Is that not something that people ought to be worried about?
Well, I again, like fear, worry is also a slayer of love. It's worry is fear taking ownership of the body. You know, I would ask you, is it productive to worry if your child doesn't arrive home on time?
Well, it doesn't change anything because they're not there. So no, it doesn't change anything, but is it a natural inclination to worry about like kids as an example, like what ifs?
I think a better way to handle that is to teach your kids etiquette, teach them to be home on time and to have consequences if they don't.
Even more reason if they don't come home to worry. If you teach your kids to respect the curfew and the rules of the house and then they're not home, I don't know how you couldn't worry.
So I've seen a scenario play out where a person was worried. Okay. And when you get so far, you can only go so far into worry, and then your emotions start to go into overdrive. And then you become illogical and irrational. So worry tends to be a gateway into stupidity. And watch if you ever have the opportunity, watch someone who's really good at worrying. Their thoughts are usually irrational. They're not based in logic. Worry tends to cause an overreaction, which can send us into a limbic hijacking. You know, in a serious situation, like if you've taught your child to come home on time and they know that there's big consequences if they don't come home and then they don't arrive home, the worst thing to do would be to go right into the stages of worry. You know, the first thing to the solution to the problem is to get in the car and go look for them or dial them up on their cell phones. But worry doesn't bring any solutions to the problem. And I don't know how many times I've talked to parents and they say, well, I'm a parent. It's my job to worry. Is it? You know, what is it accomplished? There is absolutely nothing that worry can accomplish. And if we go too far into it, it takes away our ability to be rational and it can create instability in ourselves.
Yeah, I get all of that. That makes total sense. I just wonder, though, if it's for people who feel that it's impossible not to have that emotion. Like sometimes, okay, let's put it this way. If something extreme of anything happens to you and that's what's coming at you, there's going to be an extreme response. Right. So like one of the worst case possible scenarios for me would be if my son didn't come home and he said I was going to be home at 8 and it's the next morning. I just don't know how I wouldn't worry. Like I really don't know, because that seems to me like such an automatic response, like the same thing as if you hit me in the leg with a baseball bat. I'm going to say, ow, man, my leg, that really, really hurts. Like pain is going to overrun my body and I'm going to feel pain. Yeah. How do I block out the pain from my mind? Well, I'm probably not going to be able to do that. It's just going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I wonder. Like, that just seems like such a challenging proposition not to worry. I get it if someone's worried about something that's not worth worrying about. But when we're dealing with things that are...
Well, and that's sort of what we're kind of talking about. We're talking about the anatomy of worry and what does worry do for us. And maybe, you know, if on rare occasions... And worry comes into our experience, it's not such a terrible thing, but it's there's I'm busting down the truth about what worry is. There's nothing good nor productive that ever comes out of worry. Will we experience that? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think you will experience it. But what I'm saying is that it's important when it comes to the aspect of embracing love that we start to let go of all these different behaviors that don't serve nor point us in the direction of love. And worry is one of the things that turns us in the opposite direction of love. It disempowers us, and it makes us weak in the process. So if you're a type of person who's a worry wart, or you do a lot of worrying, and you've got a label on yourself like, oh, it's just what I do, you're on notice that's a disempowering behavior. And just because you're okay with it doesn't make you stronger in the process. And it actually diminishes your ability to love, because it disempowers. It points us away. It turns us on the spot.
Yeah. And I didn't disagree with you. I just needed to challenge that a little bit. Because, you know, I mean, I know people who worry incessantly. Mm-hmm. And then from my point of view, it's like, you don't need to. It actually creates quite a lot of frustration when you're on the receiving end of someone who's worrying constantly, because it makes you feel like they know better than you in every situation, mm-hmm. which is, in a sense, kind of insulting if you're like a consenting adult and you make fairly good decisions most of the time. It's like, well, why would you need to worry? Mm-hmm. So, and that's an aggravation. Mm-hmm. I used a very extreme example of where I'm that would be the most, one of the most challenging situations to avoid worry, mm-hmm. because that's probably what people are going to think is, well, what if that happens? Mm-hmm. Like, and they'll have their own ideas of what a really worrisome situation is.
Yeah.
And you're right. It doesn't make anything any different, because there's no tangible action with worry. It's not like I'm grabbing someone's hand and pulling them out of traffic. If I just sat there and worried and then they just get hit by a car, you know, nothing's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Right. So I totally understand. So I absolutely love this line of text in the book. I'm going to quote, "Love gives your dreams permission to become your reality." What an empowering sentence that is. I just love that. I think going back to the Walt Disney thing too, like this sort of runs in line with that. So I feel that many listeners will hear that and instantly feel something. I can only imagine, because I certainly did. So in your own words, Ned, with our one life to live, how does it make you feel to see people that think their dreams were meant for other people and not for themselves?
I wouldn't know. Honestly, I'm far too busy living my dreams to worry about if other people are doing the same. I really am. I've gotten busy living in my life, and I'm far too busy enjoying my life to even like to think about the thought of somebody else not living their dreams. I think the best thing that I can do is just to fully live my own dreams. And, you know, love has been something that has taught me that dreams can really come true. I think dreams are just a preview of the future, and what's actually in store for us is much bigger than we could ever dream.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where one of the things that I learned when I was with the doctor, years ago, he introduced me to the New Thought Movement.
Okay.
So that's a series or a collection of writing out of the 1800s, 1900s. And it was a series of authors that sort of, they had this concept that thoughts are things. Okay. And so I did a lot of study in this arena, reading different works by different authors,
mm-hmm.
in the New Thought Movement. But at the end of the day, I took a course through the doctor who he learned through Bob Proctor, and the course was called The Science of Getting Rich. Now, the course was sort of appealed to the businessman or people that, you know, wanted to attract wealth in their life. But when I took the course, it was very evident after a couple days in that this was a course about manifesting your reality. But what really seemed to be missing is the inclusion of love. It talked a lot about manifesting this reality, but I think the most important thing that I took away from that whole collection of writing is that dreams are possible, and there's many people living their dreams, but when we include love, it's like we put everything on fast forward. We zoom up our dreams.
Okay.
That reality zooms up to us. It's the difference between one day shipping and 2 week shipping, you know?
Yeah.
So, but the new thought movement sort of taught me, you know, some concepts around manifesting my reality. And the things that I learned in there echoed, you know, what Disney was saying. You know, you have to, if you can see it, you can believe it, you can have it. You know, like there's many things that visionary people, mindsets that visionaries will hold because they know that their relationship to what it is they want to create in their lives. But yeah. I can say without doubt that love is sort of the thing that mega evolves all of our pursuits and speeds up the evolution of everything.
So in the form of, let's assume that it's your dreams are project based, so it's a project. And we'll use musicians for a minute. They want to earn a living as a musician. Now when we were talking about dedication versus devotion, what you're saying is you should devote yourself as a musician. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to see the result that they're likely after sooner than if they're simply just dedicated to it.
Absolutely. And it's it puts things in fast forward. You look at the very best musicians, and there has to be some love in that. They have to really love what they're doing to get to a certain level, or there's a surrender into the silence. You know, either there's a real apparent love, or there's this person has learned how to surrender into the silence within themselves, which is the nature of where love is in ourselves. So they're getting into the space of love, mm-hmm. one way or another. Whether they make it as a career, there's many motivating factors on why things happen and why they don't.
Because here's the thing with that. You just hit the nail on the head. I would say that if you're devoted to what you're doing, it doesn't guarantee success. And whatever you call success, I would probably assume some financial means, some abundance, consistent work, so on and so forth. Like you're in it. That's become your career. However, if because it's such a long road to do something like that, you need devotion to last. And so like people sometimes talking about like, well, I'll just outwork you. You know, like when you're sleeping, I'll be working, you know, that sort of shit where it's like, yeah, that's great. But like, what if you don't love what you're doing? Is the quality of what you're putting out? Is it, you know what I mean? Like sometimes the devotion is what makes something of higher quality because there was more effort put into it because they were willing to do it because they loved the process. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about how hard you work. It's about what goes into the work if you're devoted to it. I think I see it all the time. I see people who are devoted into what they do and they do have more success. They do last longer.
Well, if you pour devotion into something, that you pour love into it. And if love is God, you're pouring God into what you're doing. So what the viewer or the listener is observing is God. They're actually seeing a divine reflection through that person. And that's the thing about being an artist, is that the most beautiful paintings or tattoos or whatever medium you're looking at are the ones that are divinely inspired. or the ones that people have poured the most love into. Mm-hmm. And I've seen drawings where the artwork wasn't all that great, but it still radiated an essence of something really special. And that was reflecting back the divinity that was poured into the object that was created.
Mm-hmm. That's good food for thought for people who create.
The more love you put into life, the more life you find in love.
Like, it's like my wife always says, she's always talking about, you know, it was made with love. It's one of the catchphrases around our flower store. Mm-hmm. It's all, it was made with love. You know, I think that that is what makes everything a little bit better, a little bit sweeter, mm-hmm. for sure. So I have one last question here with this is, how do we find love in ourselves if nothing in our life is loving or good? This kind of comes back to what we talked about in sort of at the beginning, yeah. a little bit.
We have to learn how to step out of our mind. And then more than stepping out of the mind, we also have to learn how to back out of our emotions. Outside of the context of these two things, we find love. So when I step out of my mind and I step out of the emotions that are running through my body, I now can pour my attention inward to a deeper place in me. Mm-hmm. But the mind and our emotions are, again, it's what keeps us distracted from experiencing the depths of love. You know, people have claimed their identity through their thoughts and their feelings. And if your identity is wrapped up in what you feel, then you're reduced to a feeling in your body, and that's not who you are. If you wake up and your stomach hurts and you could spend the whole day wallowing in that, I've got a sore tummy, I'm in pain, you know, like, and that really becomes your day. Or if you wake up and you have an emotion like I'm feeling angry today, that could be your whole day. I'm angry. Are you? Or is that just a feeling in your body? How does an emotion become you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a simple, fleeting emotion. You know, when an emotion becomes who we are, we've greatly reduced the truth of who we are at a soul level. And that's love.